Hello, folks. Welcome back to the High Performance Human Podcast. I'm your host, Simon Ward, founder of thetriathloncoach.com, High Performance Human, and the SWAT Inner Circle. And I am on a mission to help you upgrade your human performance. I truly believe that we all have the potential to perform better as humans through improved sleep, nutrition, and stress management. And in doing so, live longer, live healthier, and of course, improve your athletic fitness. If you're interested in joining me on this journey, check out my SWAT Inner Circle, where our January special offer still has a few days left to run, and which you can sign up to with a 33% discount on a 12-month membership. Just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com. All right, this week's podcast is one of my favourites from the archives. Way back in January 2018, I sat down with one of the foremost running coaches in the world, Malcolm Brown, MBE. And Malcolm knows a thing or two about helping athletes to run faster, as he was a national endurance coach for British Athletics, working with such athletes as Kelly Holmes and Paula Radcliffe, before moving to triathlon at the very start of the Leeds Performance Centre. And during that time, he guided Alistair and Johnny Brownlee to Olympic medals at London 2012 and at Rio 2016. And he also helped Vicky Holland, Non Stanford, Georgia Taylor Brown and Jess Learmonth work their way through to the very top of the world triathlon rankings. This was originally a two-part podcast, and we've joined it together so you can hear the full conversation in one go as Malcolm and I get into the weeds about how to be a better runner. We talk about things like why it's important to relish training and just enjoy being a runner, and why endurance sports require a long-term approach over several years. That means you shouldn't check your progress for at least 12 months, and in doing so, avoid changing the plan until that time. Malcolm's observed many qualities that top athletes need to succeed, and there are two that you should have as well. And there are also three basic principles underpinning your ability to run fast. Why it's better to be a steady Eddie than a shooting star, and to be enthusiastic equally about recovery as you are about training. And finally, once we all get back to racing again, how the best performances come when you're committed physically, mentally, and emotionally. So let's cut the chatter and crack on with today's guest, Malcolm Brown. Malcolm, thank you very much for being a guest on today's show. I'm really pleased that you've been able to join us.
That's fine, Simon. Thank you for coming along to my my humble abode.
Not too much of a trip for me, though. Just up the road, a 10-minute journey. So, and hopefully my throat, which is a little croaky today, will hold out. So we've got this subject, Malcolm. I guess as a running coach and somebody who's known for producing people who run fast, one of the things you get asked quite a lot is, how can I run faster? It's something I get asked quite a lot, but I thought that you'd be in a better position to help me answer this. So how can we go about helping age group triathletes or runners to become faster?
It's a very difficult question, and the faster people get, the harder that it is to answer that. So you can imagine if Alistair Brownlee says, "I want to run even faster," you know, you are really scratching your head. But I think there are some basic principles that can apply to Alistair as well as to age groupers. And these principles are useful to sort of match your own training program against, and to see if actually it does match up. And one of the things I've discovered over the years of coaching, you know, a lot of people now, is that people are very, very different. The differences between people are greater than the similarities in many ways. So one of the principles really is that you are an individual. What suits you in terms of your training program, in terms of what you can fit in, may not suit anybody else, and vice versa. So just adopting somebody else's proven training program may not be a bad thing, but it has to be wrapped around you as an individual.
So there'd be a certain amount of trial and error in that first, to find out which bits worked for you and which bits didn't.
Absolutely. There's a lot of trial and error. And unfortunately, unlike a scientific experiment, you can never be absolutely sure that if you'd done something different, that would have been even better than what you've got. So alongside the principle of individualization, I think must be a notion that providing you're making progress, even if it's small progress, you're more likely to be on the right lines, doing the right things, than not.
So, but that sometimes that progress gets halted, doesn't it? Even in that process of working on and doing the right things and having found a program that works for you, that process can go backwards. You can feel like actually you're running worse, or you're running slower, or swimming, or cycling even. And often that's when people get derailed, because they think that then the program's failing them, and then they chop and change. And of course, then it does start to fail them.
Yes. Well, one of the things I've learned from looking at the top athletes around over the years, so they have two very important psychological qualities. One is patience, and the other is confidence. And they're two sides of the same coin, and they're willing to give a lot of time to a program. The reason they're willing to do that is that they have confidence that on balance, what they're doing is much more likely to be right than wrong.
Okay, and where does that confidence come from then? Does that confidence instilled by the coach, or is that an inner confidence that they've developed themselves?
I think it's very hard for coaches to instill confidence. What tends to happen is that athletes choose, in the world I live in, athletes choose coaches they have confidence in. If you're an embryonic international athlete, you've usually got some choice about where you go and what you do. And they tend to... And if they have got that confidence, they then are willing to persist and be patient and wait for the inevitable, and deal rather with the inevitable sort of bumps in the road that come along in everybody's training program. But by and large, one would expect to see progress, whether you're running, cycling or swimming, on an annual basis.
Right.
And I wouldn't encourage anybody to make significant changes in a well thought out program and in less than a 12-month period.
Well, that's quite interesting then, because what a lot of people will do is they will expect to be seeing, they've read somewhere that physiological changes can take 6 to 8 weeks, and so they'll be expecting that progress has been achieved within that, and if it hasn't, they'll probably be looking to make tweaks in the plan at that point. But you're saying you really need to wait for a whole season and then review what went right and what went wrong, and at that point you make the changes.
Absolutely. And if I can give an example of Vicky Holland, who came to Leeds probably around the age of 26, 27, had been to two or three other coaches, spent 3 years with each coach, and given a real good shot, at least 3 years. So she came to Leeds in around 2013. Late 2012, early 2013. It was 18 months really before she saw any benefit from the new training methodologies that she was working with in Leeds. And that was a tough 18 months for her, because she'd moved her home, the rest of it. But she was willing to be patient, and patience and confidence are really important.
Okay, so, there's probably no figure that you can put on for how much people can improve, because, again, it depends on how much capacity they still have available, doesn't it? You mentioned Alistair at the end there saying if they came to you and said, I'd like to run faster, you might be squeezing a second or two off his 10K or 5K time. For somebody who's been involved in the sport for a couple of years, there might be a huge capacity that you've got to work with. So it's impossible to put a figure on what sort of gains somebody could expect.
Oh, no, it's absolutely impossible. But what I would say, I'll give an optimistic message here, Sam. I would say don't put ceilings on what gains you expect people to make, because I have been fortunate enough to coach athletes who have absolutely surprised me. One of them you've had on your earlier podcast is a physio now called Alison Rose. And when Alison came to me when I was coaching her, She was a 3,000 metre runner who was struggling to break 10 minutes. And she ended up running for Great Britain at the marathon in the World Championships. There wouldn't have been many people who would have predicted that. And another runner from Leeds, Tracy Morris, at the mid-30s. There is not an expert in Britain in the marathon who would have predicted that Tracy Morris, age 34, would, before her 40th birthday, have run in the World and Commonwealth and Olympic marathon, because we only selected three of them, and one place was taken, that was Paula's. So there was only two places left, and Tracy managed that. Nobody would have predicted that. So it's an optimistic message I'm giving here. We don't know what it potential is, and you have probably got more potential than you think.
But one of the things that I experience with a lot of age group athletes, whether they be runners or triathletes, is that they'll have a target. So they'll have a time that they've run. So let's say they've run a standard distance triathlon and they've run a 45-minute 10K. Or if it's a standalone race, they'll have run a 40-minute 10K. And then they'll say, right, well, yeah, I've set a target of 36 minutes. You know, who knows where that target's come from? But is that target in itself self-defeating by having something to aim for like that? Because it's it either limiting in terms of what they're aiming for versus what you've just mentioned, or just such an overwhelming target that they try too hard to get there and they get injured or ill on the way.
Yes, well, I think exactly as you say, both those cases. We can take somebody like Jess Learmonth. You know, 4 years ago, who would have said, if you said to Jess 3 years ago, your target is to finish on the podium in the world final in Rotterdam in 3 years' time, that probably would have laughed at you. But that's what she did. Probably did it, and Ray, her coach, will tell us, probably did it on an incremental basis. We're going to try to get better each season. At the end of each season, we'll review and we'll set other targets. But they weren't limiting targets. They were optimistic.
Okay.
And I think that's really important. But what mustn't happen, of course, is that you think you've failed when you've done personal best, so you've improved, but you haven't made this rather arbitrary time target that you mentioned just there.
Okay. Very good. So, and that's a good point there, is that, you know, not failing to reach a lofty target isn't failure. It's just, you know, may have just demonstrated that the target was unrealistic.
Correct.
So we've got this principle of individualization. We have to recognize that everybody else is made differently to us. You know, it's obvious as coaches to us that we look at everybody and their different ages and sizes and body types. But not just that, that people can cope with different training loads, that they have different lifestyles.
Yeah.
So it's imperative that the athlete and the coach recognises that and finds a programme that works for them.
Yeah.
So your next principle sort of links in with some of the stuff we just talked about the patients, and it was, I think it was consistency. So could you elaborate on that one a little?
Yes. I've seen athletes who are, if you like, steady eddies. They turn up for training, they're always there, they're always conscientious, and then they go away. And I've seen shooting stars. I've seen people who, when they turn up, do fantastic sessions, very promising, very optimistic, and then after 2 or 3 weeks of that, they sort of fade away and life has taken over, and then they return again in 6 weeks' time. And I won't give the names of these various individuals. But there is absolutely no doubt that the consistent, steady eddies are the ones who ultimately achieve their potential or very close to it. And the shooting stars are the ones who, at the end of their careers, are saying, I could have been a champion. I was a contender.
Yeah.
I was a contender. And that's the difference. So, after the principle of individualization, your program, you need your program, not anybody else's, is the issue of consistency. That this, we're in the long game. The great thing about endurance is that you will get better. The frustrating things about endurance is it takes time. There was a sprinter called Adam Jamili who was playing football at Christmas and in the Olympic team for 2012 for Great Britain in April or May, whenever they selected the team. It doesn't happen in endurance. You know, there was nobody playing football at Christmas and was in our, you know, the endurance team for 2012. It takes time. That's why it's so enjoyable.
Yeah, and that's a principle that everybody can apply, not just the elites, but all of the age groupers. And it does worry me sometimes that everybody seems to be in a hurry. Yes. To now, I mean, they seem to be in a hurry to get faster. They seem to be in a hurry to tick off this and that and the other. And maybe it's a symptom of, maybe it's human nature, maybe it's a symptom of today's society.
Yeah.
But certainly in my time in triathlon, you know, when we first started, it took a few years to work your way up to being able to do an Ironman. Now, I know people that not just their first triathlon or their first Ironman is Ironman Lanzarote, it's their first triathlon. Yes. Sometimes their first open water swim is the hardest Ironman in Europe and in the world.
Yes.
I mean, talk about going straight in at the deep end, but it's almost like they're in a hurry to do this. And but it almost seems like it's unsustainable as well, because you have to build that, you know, the old adage that we use as coaches about building a firm foundation takes time as well.
Yes, it does. And I think really, if you are going to achieve your potential, it is going to take time. And if it is going to take time, you need to enjoy the actual process of doing it and find rewards in the training. And the race is really important, and you know, I'm not underestimating that. But I find that people who can be consistent, and we may talk about consistency again in a while, but are the ones who actually really relish being with their training buddies or in the pool or on the bike or and the rest of it. And yes, it's hard work, but they're actually enjoying the process, the here and now, as much as focusing on Ironman Lanzarote or whatever it might be.
Well, I mean, that's quite interesting. I did a podcast with a guy, it's just been released this week. It was a two-part podcast, and we were discussing a particularly huge result he had on the bike in a test, which created a bit of internet chatter. But when we actually talked about this in his podcast, it became very apparent that this was a minor significance to him, and the most important thing were the process of training, the position it fitted or he occupied within his life and as part of his lifestyle.
Yeah.
That he enjoyed the process of training and the process of trying different training methods to see which ones had the most effect on his body.
Yeah.
That you know, like in the same way that brushing your teeth is a lifelong thing, we don't sort of like it's not like a diet where we do it for 3 months until we've got nice teeth.
Yeah.
It's a lifelong thing that we just do as a habit. He sees it as that, and
yeah,
he's not in it for the short term. He's in it for the long term benefits to his health. And if he does a race on the side of that, then that's a bonus.
Yeah.
That he enjoys. And so he very much epitomizes that, relishing the process.
Yes. And I think it takes time to actually, and a sort of maturity to actually come to that position in your life as well. So if you're not there at the moment, you know, if you're not, don't think you'll never get there. You know, you can come to enjoy swimming at 7 a.m. in the morning. You can come to enjoy cycling in January in Yorkshire, you know. And you, even if you're not a runner, and I've said this to somebody like Lucy Hall, who's a swimmer, who wants to be a 10K runner. That, when you just think about that, that is a real toughie.
Yeah.
And I've said the first step on that, Lucy, is for you to actually notice the leaves on the trees and enjoy being outside, being fit, being young, and that the leaves on the trees change as you go through the year. Once you start to enjoy that, you are starting to be a runner. And that's not about Garmins, and that's not about heart rates, and it's not about how far you've run, how fast. It's actually about enjoying being a runner. And once you can enjoy being a runner, you're on your way to running a good 10K.
Well, and actually, in this process, because we've not actually talked about what speed is or how to develop it, but a lot of people seem to overlook the fact that if you were just to run regularly every other day for 12 months, you would be a better runner. You'd have better balance. you'd feel a lot more comfortable. You'd naturally find the right running gait and everything, and your running performances would improve without going to the track, without doing intervals, without absolutely hammering yourself all the time.
And without the anxiety that comes from either having or having not achieved the time, which is usually pretty arbitrary that you've set yourself. Anyhow, so enjoying the process, I think we're talking about here, and that is part of consistency.
Okay, so let's just cover a few, because you and I are, and I know that Alison's also very keen on this. How do we enhance our consistency? What steps can we take? And maybe four or five of them, things that we can do on a daily basis, the here and now, as you mentioned, to make sure that we maintain our consistency. Because I think Alison's statistic is that running contributes to about 80% of triathlon injuries. So it's the area where you most like to get injured as a triathlete.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's the area where we most need to be mindful of avoiding those injuries to maintain that consistency.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And most of those injuries will be from the knee downwards. So we can actually be quite specific.
Yeah.
So if lower limb resilience, I would describe it as, is pretty important for maintaining your ability to train consistently, i.e. not get injured and turn up and be able to deliver your training schedule. And, you know, there are plenty of websites and YouTube clips of various exercises that you can do for calf strengthening, for Achilles tendon strengthening, and for balance and coordination. And those are what I would suggest have to be in your program, ideally twice a week, if not more. Alison would have told you how many times a week. Mm. And that's what we've done with all our triathletes, is to, they not only do their hours on the bike and their 30 hours of training or whatever it might be, but they also do 2 by 1 hour, sometimes 3 by 1 hour gym sessions. They go to the gym to do it at the Brownlee Centre, in order to build that resilience and ability to absorb the physical forces that running creates.
So we're not, and this would probably come under the heading of the strength and conditioning program, although it's not what most people might think. And if, you know, talking about going to the gym and doing their leg curls and their squats and their lunges, we're talking about building resilience in a very small way, in a very small number of muscles. It, that doesn't mean we'd ignore the other ones, but and it's again coming back to that patience and being able to take time. This is stuff that you need to do, like brushing your teeth. It just has to be done every week. It doesn't, it's not a progressive program where you can see you're making big gains in your calf size.
Yeah.
It's just doing drills and small muscle strengthening and stability.
And this is what I would say has been a big change in the last 10 years. This is latest information, folks. 20 years ago, you know, we felt that in running, the Kenyans didn't do much of this sort of stuff. Actually, they do, but they do body weight type work. They do drills, hopping, skipping, coordination in groups, in packs. And so they don't have the sophistication of gym facilities in many cases that we have, but they do that work. And Alistair and Johnny have benefited over the years. Alistair is now, having just come back from a significant operation, and already is running very well. And he runs technically well because he's strong.
That's interesting there, though, that you talk about the Kenyans, because one difference between the Kenyans and the Western European lifestyle is that they probably don't spend quite as much time sitting down and you know, not using their muscles as part of their normal daily routine and activity. They have a more robust lifestyle, which probably gives them some inbuilt resilience anyway.
Well, certainly in their formative years, you know, until they become, you know, professional athletes, then they rest better than we do. They learn how to do that. But, you know, I've been to Ethiopia and I've seen the Ethiopians, and, you know, in training, and they do a huge amount of mobility, flexibility, coordination and strengthening work alongside their running.
Might be interesting to talk about the Kenyan way. We touched upon in our pre-podcast discussions about polarized training.
Yeah.
And that's something that the Kenyans are often linked with quite heavily. And you either run really easy or you run very, very hard.
Yeah.
But there often isn't a lot of that sort of, a great deal of that sort of tempo threshold running in there. So would that form part of the next principle of speed, do you think?
Yes, I think if in terms of a hierarchy of priorities, I think for people to run faster, after individualization, after consistency, and then patience and confidence, these are the sort of things you need to test yourself against, I think, as an age grouper. These are the things that you're good at. You know, are you doing... then we start to look at the technical side of it, if you like. And I was always of the opinion that we benefited more by doing significantly polarized training, whereby our easy running is very, very easy, probably not measured, probably not monitored, just as we feel, which is effectively a form of recovery from the other training that you're doing. And then twice a week, you'd be running fast or faster than race pace. And this is really for Olympic distance triathlon. So, you know, my expertise lies more in there than anywhere else. So I would suggest that if you are wanting to run faster than if you want to run your race faster than you've done before, then you have to do that in training. In most cases, there's always the exception, but in most cases, that's a way forward. Once in a week, we'd be doing what might be described as VO2 max type intensity, and another time, we'd be doing sort of 10K lactate threshold type intensity.
Okay, but always, so in let's use Alistair and Johnny there and use that 30 minute per 10K threshold that you know that they were trying to really get under for 2012, so trying to run faster than that. So they'd be doing repetitions where their kilometer pace was faster than it was 20 kilometers an hour pace, that isn't it? So they'd be trying to run faster than that.
Yes, so once a week, and I mean this is a whole interesting area in itself. I haven't got much time, but once a week, without fail, 48 weeks of the year, whether they're in Tenerife, in Spain, in Beijing, or in the Field of Champions in Leeds, they would run hard for the best part of 30 minutes. Because it's in the winter in Leeds, they may not achieve 3 minutes per kilometer, which is a pace that you suggested they're aiming for, but the intensity and the ambition is that it will be. Because if you're running on grass and it's long and it's wet, or you're in snow, you can't run at that.
So they're doing a 30-minute run. It's not 30 minutes broken up as intervals.
No, it's broken up as intervals.
Right, sorry. Okay.
Thanks for clarifying that. And the maximum they will ever get to is 30 minutes. And usually it's 20 or 25 because we want them to run faster than race pace.
So that's the total duration of the high-intensity running.
Of the high-intensity running, okay. Exactly. The recoveries will be added on top of that 20, 25, 30 minutes. But that's the principle of it. And it's the principle rather than the detail. Oh, mind you, we want everything here, don't we? That is important. And you know what? There's a mindset that is created by having the mindset of doing that. So they come knowing they're going to run hard. No excuses. Doesn't matter what the wind's like, what the underfoot conditions are like, who else is training with them. They're going to do it. And I think that has helped them when they get off the bike in the race, attack the 10K, whatever the conditions, whoever's around, because they've done it for 48 weeks of the year for the last 10 years.
And whatever they feel like, because, you know, let's think about all of those races that, let's say Johnny, for instance, had that amazing spell of 3 or 4 years where he wasn't off the podium. In races where even a loose buckle on your helmet in transition would have made the difference between getting on that podium, and then there'll have been days when he felt great and there'll have been days when he didn't, but he was still able to run fast when he didn't feel good, because he's turned up 48 weeks of the year to run fast, and on probably a large number of those he would have felt tired and, you know, not really feeling like he wanted to run fast.
Just as physiologically you can train and develop the mitochondria to multiply, I believe that in the brain, you can train the brain to be inured against fatigue and all the stresses of life, because every Saturday morning you've done it.
Well, Malcolm, we're coming to the end of our 30 minutes now. That's been fantastic. And you alluded to a couple of things, which I know we're going to talk about in part two of our podcast next week. But let me just summarise then. So we're really bringing it down to three principles here. Individualisation, so find a programme that works for you, nobody else. Be consistent and do everything you can to enhance that consistency, particularly lower leg resilience through strength and conditioning and drills and balance. And then, on a regular basis, seek to run in small intervals, whatever, but at least every week at a pace that's faster than your race pace, so you get used to it on race day and you can drop into it automatically.
Yep, and next week we'll have some more secrets.
Okay, folks, I hope you enjoyed that first part and you made lots of notes about how to help yourself be a faster runner. In what was the second part of the podcast, Malcolm and I dive a little deeper into some of the psychology behind faster running. And by the end of this, you'll really appreciate the fact that you've got to truly relish and love running in order to run at your best. So let's go with part two.
Malcolm is the perfect person to talk to about our subject today, which is athlete psychology. So you're not a sports psychologist, Malcolm, but I guess you've had a really close quarter view of athlete psychology, not just in training, but also in racing and performance.
Yes, I have. And I've been lucky, really. I've seen some of our best British endurance athletes in triathlon and in endurance running being tested in Olympic arenas. I remember in Sydney Olympics in 2000, taking Kelly Holmes into an arena of 120,000 spectators, and she was one of only eight people in the stadium. It was the Olympic 800 meter final, and you can imagine the pressure that you must feel, you know, when all eyes in that stadium are on you, and goodness knows how many millions or billions even across the world, you know. So I've seen people being really challenged and rising to the challenges and succeeding as well.
Makes you wonder what sort of pressure Kathy Freeman was under during that, because she was not just in front of those number of people, but also the darling of the sport, and sort of nailed on to win that medal as far as all the pundits were concerned. But
and the Brownies in Hyde Park had one or two people watching them as well.
Yes they did. But of course, the Olympic Games comes around once every 4 years, so there is an awful lot of pressure riding on that particular tournament event that the athletes are going to be competing in. But before then, there's several hundred days of training, maybe several thousand days, because it's not usually just one four-year cycle. It's you know, we talk about Alistair and Johnny there, right back to the early 2000s. So 8 to 10 years of training.
Yeah.
So we need to perhaps talk about the athlete psychology on a daily basis, not just on the one performance every 4 years.
No, absolutely. And unless athletes can handle the demands of the day-to-day training, then they're not going to be prepared and able, in fact, to get to those massive events where we all witness, you know, their successes and trials and tribulations. And having looked at these athletes in their training environments over a number of years, it seems to me that the best are the ones who can live in two worlds, really. The day-to-day world, the here and now, who can get on with this training session and to deal with the ups and downs of any one particular training session. But at the same time, every now and then, maybe every week or every couple of weeks, just look at the horizon and see what direction they're going in towards their ultimate goals.
So, I mean, at the very start of this sentence, we were referring to elite athletes, but the majority of our listeners are not going to be elite athletes. But that doesn't mean that the principles that we're going to talk about now and for the next 20 or so minutes do not apply to them. They're exactly the same principles of, you know, focusing on the training and the daily activities you have to enhance that in here and now, and occasionally looking up to take a peek at your long-term goal.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. Because everybody in their daily life can get distracted, sidetracked, deflected, because life throws a lot of things at you. And also you can find reasons for not doing things. There's plenty of reasons for not training. There are plenty of reasons for changing your training, making your training easier, doing this, that, and the other. And I find that the most successful athletes are the ones who, by and large, stick to the program, don't worry too much about the outcome of any particular training session. They may reflect back on it if it's not gone well, and they may reflect on why it hasn't gone well and were those reasons in their control, for example, but they don't worry about any one particular session, because any one session in the lifetime of an athlete is almost infinitesimal in terms of its contribution. But one of the ironies is you need to do every session as well. One of the paradoxes of training is that if you took that attitude to all training sessions, you wouldn't do any at all. So they are important, but they're unimportant. And it's holding that ambiguity in your mind without it driving you nuts is really important.
Well, I suppose the reverse of that is that one great session doesn't suddenly mean that you're a world-beating athlete. I mean, it's not a fluke, because that's what you're capable of, and you probably want to be wondering how you can do that more often. But equally, one bad session because you slept well the day before, or because, you know, your mum or dad wasn't feeling very well and you had other things on your mind, your life events, doesn't mean that you're a bad athlete, does it? It's that long-term progress.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, in endurance, which is what we're talking about, it is that gradual incremental layering upon layer of fitness and development over a week, over weeks, over a month, and so on and so forth, that ultimately enable you to fulfill your potential as an athlete. So no one session is critical, but every session is critical.
I quite often use the analogy of a brick wall. Is that if you and I, looking outside of your window now, Malcolm, there's a brick wall out there, but if we were going to build Donald Trump's brick wall, you know, the entire length of the southern United States, we'd start with one brick. Now, there could be some fantastic looking bricks in there, but each one of those bricks has a place within that wall. And without that brick, missing one brick probably won't affect the integrity of that wall a great deal, will it? Or one badly placed brick won't. If there's lots of missing bricks, then the brick will have holes in it, and, you know, it won't be such a good wall. But we need all of those bricks to make that big wall built up over time. You can't build it up in a few hours. It takes time. It takes patience. Mm. It takes you turning up every day to do the same job.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And as I say, not to get too derailed by the success or failure or the not such a good performance in any one session. And that's very, very difficult. You know, you'd be surprised how vulnerable even some of our greatest athletes are to emotional ups and downs if training has gone less well than they thought it should. So it's not a bad thing to feel upset and a bit put out by a training session that hasn't gone well. What does matter is that you aren't derailed by that you keep your commitment.
So you have to respond to that poor session in the right way. You have to be pragmatic about looking at why it didn't go so well. Yeah. Was it because you didn't recover? Was it because you had mistimed your eating patterns? Was it because you've got other things on your mind? And then move forward from that and make sure it doesn't happen again.
Yes, and sometimes, you know, you can run through all those and you don't come up with a clear answer. And then you just have to say, well, it was one of those things. You can't say that every time, but sometimes it's a mystery. The human body is actually pretty much a mystery. And You can't always find the cause of it. But the main thing is that you turn up the next time and keep on training and keep on going and don't get caught up in the here and now and allow it to derail you.
We talked about the here and now before, didn't we? I think in our previous podcast. But so as preparing for events is probably going to occupy 99% of our yearly time, we should probably spend a little bit more time about how we can make sure that our psychological approach or our approach to training is robust. You mentioned in one of our chats about the Seven Habits of Effective People, which is by Stephen Covey, which is a book that I hear referred to regularly in many different spheres. But there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
In terms of successful people, not just successful athletes.
Yeah. Well, I think it came out of the original time management movement, which, whilst useful initially, was very partial, very incomplete, and it didn't acknowledge the fact that people had lives outside of work, that they had partners, children, commitments, obligations, fun. And Stephen wrote something which I think was very, very appropriate for business leaders, business people, to fulfill their potential. But also, I think, for athletes, in that it required you to sit down once a week, probably on a Sunday night before the working week started on Monday morning, and allocate time and space to all your obligations that week. And so it was a very, very useful planning tool, and it's in there in the book, in the pro forma, to enable you to get through the training week with the highs and the lows and the must-dos and the maybe I'll get to if I have a good week, but if I don't, it's not the end of the world. And I think with sport, it's very, very similar. The planning process, planning when you're going to train, how you're going to get to the training, how you're going to get from the training, how long that's going to take, are you going to eat in the car, are you going to eat beforehand? I'm getting that plan, but over a seven-day cycle. So it's not a huge long cycle and it's not a short, it's tomorrow, it's 7 days, and it gives you a sense of calmness and purpose. And I think it's really valuable.
So what you're actually talking about there, Malcolm, is that the individual actually has to step out of their routine for a little bit and do a bit of manual labour. You know, they've got this training plan, but that training plan has to be dovetailed into the week as well and based around not just going to work and coming back from work and doing work, but what the family wants to do and other life events and how these things are all going to dovetail together to make the training work properly.
I think that's exactly it. It's a more human way of approaching being a serious athlete. In that it does acknowledge the other things that go on in your life and doesn't try to just ignore them or ride roughshod over them or allow them to come up and knock you on the head. And the planning period of 7 to 8 days, I think we can all do, and our lives are more predictable around that sort of time frame. If we try to plan for 6 weeks or 8 weeks, the planning becomes a little bit looser towards the end of that period, because how can we know, you know, whether we'll be healthy or whatever's going on in sick. But for 7 or 8 days, we can more or less predict what's coming up. And I think that's why it's a really good discipline for athletes.
In some ways, if we relate that to the comments you made earlier about, you know, the fact that you need to make peace with yourself about having good and bad sessions, but just get them done, is this idea, particularly in the lives of the the listeners here, where they do have lots of stuff going on, is that some weeks it's not going to be possible to do the amount of training you would like. But doing less training isn't really going to have a huge significance in the long run over a period of 12 months or 2 years. It may feel like you've done less, and as long as it's not a permanent fixture that you have to reduce your training load down, the actual rest is probably going to be beneficial. But acknowledging the fact that you can only do 3 or 4 key sessions this week instead of the 2 you do per day isn't a problem really in the long term if you're taking a long-term approach.
No, absolutely. And recovery and regeneration, we don't know as much about those areas as we do about the effect of work on fitness. But recovery and regeneration, having time away from the training, is when the adaptation takes place and actually sets you up for the next block, next training sessions better. So yes, we need to have progressive overload. Yes, we need to tire our bodies, but we also need to be able to recover from that. And if you layer on top of being very tired from training all the stresses of a work life and a family life, then you're probably heading for a bit of a problem.
So we do need to build into this week where we're cleverly building in our training and diligently packing our kit at the beginning of the day so we can rush straight from the office to the track or to the gym. We also need to plan in time for recovery. We need to plan a day off. We need to plan a time when we're going to go for a massage, go to the sauna, spend a couple of hours just listening to some music and downloading, if you like, or decompressing away from this rather than the hustle and bustle of life that sort of has us switched on all the time.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really, really important thing. It's important for athletes who are full-time athletes. So it's doubly important for those who are fitting their training around everyday life.
Just get one more thing going back to that planning is that when life events do come in and you know, you have to work late and then that squeezes your time and it means you're stuck in traffic and you can't get to the club session, there's nothing more frustrating for an active person, including people like ourselves, to not be able to do what they planned to do.
Yeah.
But again, that one session isn't going to have a huge impact on the overall plan.
No. And if I take it back to Alistair Brownlee in a different zone, as it were, one of the things that's always impressed me about him is that when on occasions he's not been able to train in the same location, which he's been going to for year after year, you know, because something's cropped up, he's the most relaxed person about changing the program. And everybody else around him is, you know, this is a, you know, the end of the world because we can't run on this grass or we can't swim in that pool or we can't. And he's the one who is the least put out by it, yet he's the one who's got the most to lose, one would imagine, by it. So trying to adopt that sort of attitude where the training matters, but at times it doesn't.
Mm.
Because you know that you're going to train for the rest of the year and you're going to make up the time and you'll actually be better from having this little break than you would be if you forced it.
Okay, so an example would be they have to go to London to do some sponsorship duties, they have to get on the train, it means they miss the swimming session in the morning and they've maybe got some running kit, but they're only able to go for a run for 30 minutes. It's a 30-minute run, it's better than nothing. They have to do it in Hyde Park with all the other commuters and joggers. But that's it. It's just one day out of that. And there's other things that they have to fulfill on that day. And then tomorrow they'll just get back on the routine and it'll all be forgotten about. Yeah. Rather than just jumping up and down and creating a fuss and up in the blood pressure, complaining about it.
No, it's been really instructive to watch how they deal with it. And indeed how other athletes struggle to deal with it, but are learning to deal with it.
Yeah.
And it's been remarkable to see Alistair and Johnny move from promising athletes to rock stars and manage it all.
Yes, and just seemingly carry on as normal as they were, as we both knew them when they were sort of teenagers.
Indeed.
Just getting on with the training.
And really because they enjoy the process. as we discussed previously.
Well,
previous time.
Yes, relishing the process. Yeah, I mean, we're looking out of here now, Malcolm. It's the middle of the afternoon in early January. It's a grey day. It's much more inviting to be inside here in the warmth with a coffee having a chat than it is to be out there riding. But I can guess that that's what they'll be doing now with their mates, and they'll be enjoying it.
Yeah.
And today might not be a stellar ride. It might just be a ride dealing with shitty traffic and shitty road conditions.
Yeah.
But it'll be a ride, and it'll be another brick in the wall.
Yeah.
And they'll get back. And I guess they're probably not jumping for joy and slapping each other on the back about having had a great session. But they're probably also be thinking that there's probably 101 other things that they'd rather not be doing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And they've now got to a stage where if they don't train, they don't sleep and they don't eat as well, and they feel, you know, that something's wrong. So their normal is movement, whereas unfortunately the majority of the population, it's the reverse.
But equally, they won't get really stressed if they don't train.
No. They've got the ability to take with the rough with the smooth, you know, which is, it's full of paradoxes, but it's an interesting observation.
Okay, so we've talked about the psychological approach to training. So let's just summarise on that. We really need to take a long-term approach.
Yeah.
We need to take an approach that individual sessions, whether they're standout sessions or not quite up to our normal performance, don't really matter as long as you've turned up and done the session.
Correct.
That being too critical of your performance on that particular session, or even comparing your performance versus somebody else in that particular session, is just a mere snapshot in time and not indicative of overall performance or progress towards the long-term goal.
Yeah.
And that really you need to spend most of your time focusing on what you need to do now, not just what training, but what you need to get done to enable that training to happen and to enable you to recover from it. But you do occasionally need to stick your head up and look at the horizon, but then put your head down immediately and not get too focused on that, and just make sure you stay on track.
Yeah, no, that's a very good summary, yeah.
Okay, so assuming that we've been able to do all of that and we've introduced some of the principles that we talked about in podcast one about having a program that works for us and being consistent, which is part of what we've just talked about, and done the right training to enable us to improve, but still understanding that it's an act of faith, as Franz Stampfer once said, you know, we can't guarantee performance is going to happen. All we can do is make sure we're in the right ballpark. We're going to go to our key competitions. Now, you mentioned that in athletics, that really in a big athletic season, what will it be this year? So it's the Commonwealth Games this year, but normally you've got the World Championships or the Olympics. So you've got two significant races that are really important.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things I was able to bring to triathlon in Leeds was from my athletics experience, which was the process of peaking, really. And there's no doubt that in athletics, it's a bit of an art. And I was always very pleased that the athletes I coached were able to peak at the key race of the year, which in most of their cases was the national championships. It used to be called the 3A championships, because that was always a selection race for the major championships, you know, the world global championships. So basically, most athletes who are at a very high level are required to compete at the selection race and then compete, if they're provided and they're selected, at the Worlds. And you want them to do their two personal best performances in those races. And over 25 years of coaching in athletics, I learned how to get athletes to be able to peak twice and not more than that, and actually use development races, if you like, as a process of getting them ready for those two races.
Okay, so they've got the two key races, their A races, if you like, the performance is where they really need to shine. But that doesn't stop them from competing in other events. I mean, if we take athletics, for example, the sprinters will have the Golden League that they go to throughout the year, and they'll maybe have some domestic events that they turn up to.
Yeah.
But they're not necessarily, if they have a PB performance there, that's a bonus rather than something they're aiming for, and it'd probably be indicative of the fact that training's gone quite well. But equally, if they if they didn't, in the same vein as we talked about with daily training, if they didn't quite hit the mark that they wanted to, they wouldn't be too concerned. They'd just go back to the drawing board, work out why, and then move on.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And I think with sprinting, it's slightly different because they can compete very frequently without any major decrement to their performance. But endurance, there's always the danger that if you race too often or too intensively too often, that you start the process of going down the hill rather than up the hill. And that it's critical you know yourself and what you can do and what you can't do. But a lot of people are over-ambitious and feel they can do more and aren't kind enough to themselves to know that a race takes a huge amount out of you and that it takes time to recover from that.
And that's not just, I mean, let's not forget, a standard distance triathlon for the average age group is going to take them probably 2.5 to 3 hours.
Yeah.
So we're talking somewhere between the same effort and intensity required for a marathon.
Yeah.
You know, a fast marathon, but yeah. Nevertheless, or somewhere between a half marathon and a marathon.
Yeah.
And it's not just the physical effort of being at your limit for that time. It's also the mental effort of not just focusing for that entire period, but also the preparation for that race. Because we seem to forget that it's not just the race day. It's everything that's gone beforehand that we're also recovering from.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. And so it's physical and it's psychological, mental, but it's also emotional. And the emotion is an energy, you know. For instance, some anxiety is energy, basically. So if you feel slightly anxious, as you should be for any race, to get the most out of yourself, that consumes energy as well. So I always used to be surprised in the British athletics team how the sprinters would be exhausted after 4 rounds of 100 metres. So they basically ran 100 metres in the heat, and in the quarterfinal, and in the semi, and then the final, be absolutely wiped out on a par with a marathon runner coming across the line.
For 40 seconds worth of work for them.
For 40 seconds worth of work. And it was genuine. It was because it's emotional, physical, and psychological at the same time. And each round demanded more of them and required them to be more perfect than the previous
one. Well, it's gladiatorial, isn't it, the sprinting?
Yeah.
Gladiatorial.
Yeah. So I think there's, you know, we can learn from all sorts of different areas, and I've learned from those guys that peaking is physical, and you need to taper into it and prepare for it, but it's very, very demanding physically, so psychologically as well, and emotionally. And if you want your best performance, you have to be ready to make those commitments, physical, psychological, and emotional, to the event.
And this, assuming that we've all got a limited amount of emotional, physical, psychological energy to devote to this, there's, you know, even the people who we consider to be psychologically strong, like the Alistair and Johnny and some of the other champions we talked about, for the average age group, I wouldn't like to call it. They're not average people, are they? Most of the people that do triathlon are superhumans, really, compared to most of the human race. But for the person who's listening to this, the number of times they can go to that well in a season is limited to how many. I mean, the physiologists talk about 2 or maybe 3 peaking opportunities in a year. Do you think that's overly ambitious?
I think if you can do 3, you've had a good year. And one of those 3 will be the best, won't it? So it was the best one when you wanted it to be. I mean, that's always what I used to say, you know, especially in events that you can measure, you know, obviously triathlon you can, but it's course dependent as well as everything else. So I think what you have to try to do in peaking is do some difficult things, like turn down races, turn down opportunities to have fun, harbour your reserves, harness your emotional capabilities for the particular day, rest and recover, do all the things that triathletes don't like doing, so that you can actually explode, metaphorically speaking, in the actual race and leave it all behind. You know, when you get across the line, know that you've emptied the well.
Yeah, and I think this that you talk about the emotional thing, we find athletes that do, you know, it is physically possible to drag yourself up to do half a dozen Ironman races in a year. Nobody's disputing that. There's plenty of examples of people who've done far more than that. I'm not sure in my own mind whether the long-term benefits to your health are that good. But you mentioned earlier that if you do too many races, it just becomes the sort of a regular routine, like turning up for a training session. So you don't get up for those big races. You can't you can't draw on those emotions and that anxiety that we know actually you need to have some pre-race anxiety in order to focus your mind. But also there's often a point in training in the middle of the winter on a day like today where you look out the window and go, do you know what? I can't be bothered. Why am I bothered? And then we start questioning what's wrong with us. And actually nothing's wrong. It's just that you've drained your emotional resources so much that you need time to recharge those.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's one of the difficulties with the long endurance sports. The routine is valuable, I think, but the demands of the race can be massive. And once they become routine, because you're not putting everything into it, inevitably your performances subside a bit. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with going to a race and having a goal which is around, I'm here, I'm going to meet a few buddies, know the venue, it's a lovely course, I'm going to go drift around. Nothing wrong with that at all. It's a different form of satisfaction and purpose than going to do your best.
So I think if we were summarising this little bit then about the psychological approach to training, what we're really saying is that if you really want to do your best, however you identify your best, for me now in the sort of in the later part of my triathlon career, for me the experience of doing the event and soaking up everything that we talked about when you talked about enjoying running, for me the atmosphere, the spectators, the course, the challenge of the day, the process of getting there is far more important for me in my long-term enjoyment of the sport than an actual time. Because as you mentioned, times can change, so it's just course and weather dependent. But if you're in the position where you are aiming for a PB in a 10K race or a marathon, or you're going to a standard distance race, triathlon, or even an Ironman, and you really want to nail getting under 10 hours or going sub 2:30 or hitting a 40-minute 10K, you've really got to be very focused about when you're going to do that and putting everything into that, all the eggs into that basket.
Absolutely. And I think, and that requires a sort of the preparation in the, you know, in terms of the training, the 2 weeks going into the race, the day of the race, and then eventually the recovery from the race. So there's a whole set of different sort of logistical zones that you have to get right as well in order to be able to perform on the day.
Yeah, and as you mentioned there, it sometimes requires you to make... I'm not sure if I like that. Some people debate that word about making sacrifices because, but choices, certainly hard choices that allow you to enable to express those goals and give it your best shot, you know, lay it on the line. And we talked about Alistair and Johnny quite a lot in our two podcasts, but if we're talking about somebody who's capable of laying it all on the line when it really matters, that is a that Alistair is a perfect example of that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And if you look back on their careers, they've not raced a huge amount compared to some of their competitors, you know, because they've always protected themselves around the championships. So Alistair's, you know, wanted to do well at the Olympics. He's wanted to do well at the Europeans, wanted to do well at the Commonwealth. So has John. And in order to do that, they've missed out on some of the WTS events. So they could have taken a different view of their career, which was, I'll prioritize the WTS events and I'll go to all of those and have a few in the bank in case one or two don't go well. And I'll happen to do those championships, but they've not. They've always wanted to do well at those. So basically, I think what I'm saying is you can't have your cake and eat it in life, in Brexit and in triathlon.
Well, that's probably quite a good place to finish, Malcolm. Not that we're comfortably eating cake here, sitting around the kitchen table, but so that's been really informative. It's been a great couple of podcasts. I think they've linked quite nicely together. Today we've talked about athlete psychology. We've not really infringed anything where our learned psychology colleagues will be ringing us up to say that we've tried to tread on their toes. But what we've talked about are some real-world practical examples of how to approach everyday training and how to make sure that if you really have a goal and you really want to beat that goal, that you've got to set your stall out to achieve it on a particular day and go all in.
Yeah.
All in. And sometimes that means making decisions that are going to mean excluding things, even if it means saying no to a piece of cake or to that party, because the goal is more important to you than the short-term satisfaction of having a bit of fun or a piece of cake.
Yeah, good summary. Well done, Simon.
Thanks to Malcolm for joining me on the High Performance Human podcast. Before you go, just a reminder that if you're interested in being part of my SWAT Inner Circle, our January special offer still has a few days remaining, and you can take advantage of our 33% discount by emailing beth@thetriathloncoach.com. We'll be back next week with another fantastic guest, but in the meantime, stay healthy and stay focused on being a high performance human in every aspect of your life.